This is the Creative Sports Podcast.
My name is Justin Peterson.
And joining me are Brock Rahm and Garrett Wright.
Rolling I like your credit card holder there on the back.
I know, it's really nice. Just the Marriott card. Stay in enough Marriotts that baby pays off.
Would you like to work in primetime with the whole world watching? Zach Milliken has worked his way up to the Olympics with NBC. He builds graphics packages, and we learn how he got his foot in the door and took advantage of opportunities he was presented to get to the big stage.
Good deal. Well, then I am rolling on my end, rolling on the Zoom. Get a little time.is going, and you say the word, Justin.
Oh, I was going to let you call the shot.
All right, fine. Let's do 50. All right. Trying to tell someone outside the industry what a producer is, and even inside the industry, because there's like 10 different roles that a producer can have.
Yeah,
what a weird industry we're in, man.
Yeah, it's
so good though.
What any of us do, because the layman thinks, you know, there's a person on television, and there's a camera, and that's it.
Those are the only people that do anything on live broadcasts.
And when you invite a friend over to the truck, what the? You know,
yeah.
Look at all the screens.
Ah, that's the coolest thing. So, yeah. Hey everyone, welcome to the show. My name is Garrett Wright. I want to start out with a big thank you to APM Music for donating the tracks we use on this podcast. Also, a reminder that this podcast is an extension of the sports creative community on Slack. So if you're hearing this and not a member of that community yet, you should head over to sportscreativeslack.com and sign up for free.
Excited today to be joined by Zach Milliken, who is a freelancer and works a lot on graphics packages, working in trucks with live events, and has worked the Tokyo Olympics. So we'll definitely get into the Tokyo Olympics side of things. But first, I wanted to bring up how Zach and I met, because it was because of After Effects, actually. And I was playing around with After Effects on the plane when I used to travel with the Celtics. And Zach also traveled with the team because he worked for our RSN and did the graphics and everything there, traveling with the team, and ran the Chiron. So he walked by and was like, "Hey, I noticed that you were playing around on After Effects. That's cool." And we decided to chat shop at the bar later on, and kind of struck up a good friendship since then. So so appreciate you coming on, Zach, and helping us understand what you do and give us an insight on working the Olympics and how you got to where you are today.
For sure. It's not often you see After Effects in action on a Celtics team plane. So that was like, oh, hey, someone does what I do. I like this.
Yeah, it's cool. So you never know, I guess, bottom line is you never really know when you're playing around doing something you enjoy doing, who you're going to meet along the way. But Zach, can you give us a little bit of a background on how you got into the graphics game?
I was in a class one day and it clicked from a professor that, okay, in this business and in general, then it was like TV news for me. That was the focus. In this business, it's all about experience. And here it clicked with me. I'm like, oh, I got to get my foot in the door some way, somehow. So after that class, I called a local TV station that was, you know, within driving distance. It's like, hey, I wonder if you have any job openings. Yeah, sure. We have a camera position for a studio. Come on down, you know, we'll do an interview. So I go down there, I go through the interview process, and they're like, you don't have any experience. But I flipped the script and I started interviewing him. Like, here's a guy who I already look up to. I've only been hanging out with him for 15, 20 minutes. I want to know everything about his career, how he got here, this, this, and that. So we talked for another hour. He was eating it up. I was eating it up, just hearing someone in the real world. And, you know, we shook hands and parted ways. And a couple of months later, I get a call like, hey, you have Photoshop on your resume? What about a new weekend graphics position? And I'm like, oh, what? And so that's how it all started. So, you know, a lot of my social life kind of went down the drain on weekends, but I had a blast because here I am getting paid to work at a real TV station. and doing graphics on the weekend. So that's kind of how it all started. And the reason I had Photoshop on my resume, and this was years ago, wasn't as common because my dad is a designer and was a designer. And I just grew up, you know, seeing every art, creativity, Mac computers everywhere with just all this great software, you know, and I would just play with it for fun. So I never really took it seriously. It was just like, yeah, playing around, click here, click there. Hey, Dad, how do I do this? You know, things like that. And that's how it all started.
Wow. You mentioned that your dad kind of started that stuff like that. That feels like something that probably was maybe a little less common back then. How did your dad even get a start in Photoshop and digital design and some of that stuff?
Yeah. So as a kid, some of my favorite memories were going to work with my dad. Just loved it. Because he was surrounded by other creative people, and it wasn't just designers. Like, oh, here's the video department. Oh, here's the guy that makes sure all the brochures are printed properly, that kind of thing. And when I was really, really young, I remember going to pick up my dad at work, and we'd go in his office, and he started, you know, with the drafting table. That's where they would do all their designs. You know, pens and papers, just the old school analog way. And I just barely remember that, but it really burned, you know, memory inside my head. I just thought it was so cool. Like, there he was, you know, drawing. You know, back then maybe I had some crayons and would draw some stuff. But as his career progresses, as I got older, you know, I remember this huge computer in this room. Hey, Zach, we got this new computer. They sent me to New York to pick it out, and it's like $1 million. And you sit in the middle of the room and you draw on a tablet. And of course, I went there and I was drawing on this tablet and making little 3D balls by just wherever I pressed. It was like, whoa, this is amazing. And then, hey, Zach, I got this little computer. It sits on my desk. It's called a desktop. It's a Macintosh. And then, oh, there's this software called Altus Freehand, Adobe Photoshop. And he would, you know, before people even knew what that was, he was going to, you know, to conferences and getting trained on how to use the software.
Wow.
So it was a cool thing to witness the evolution of, like, especially to digital design. So it's, and you know, people barely even knew what Macs were. And a lot of people didn't have a Mac at home that you know, and I was very fortunate. So that's kind of how it all started as a young kid.
That's super cool. I guess how much analog do you still do today, as far as drawing or anything preparing on the side before you jump into the digital apps?
So me, pretty much, it's non-existent. And besides just sketching, trying to come up with ideas early in the stages. But my dad was a designer and a real artist. I can't claim the artist part. I just kind of claim the designer part. Like, he could just draw anything realistic or paint abstract, make sculptures. I remember even as a kid, he had this projection system and someone would hire him to do a mural. So at night after work, he would go to this place and project on the wall, and I would sit there and watch him sketch it out and then paint it. You know, for a few days, it would just to see him do all that was amazing. But he didn't really want me to do it, to do anything like he did. It just kind of happened by accident. And then he was like, whoa. So doing the real analog stuff is not something I could claim like he had the skills.
So you talked a little bit about meeting or getting into your local news station. And when they called you back a couple months later saying, hey, you have Photoshop on your resume, you want this weekend graphics job, what specifically were you doing to get your foot in the door, and how did you develop from that point on?
Yeah, so a day-to-day would be you show up, you get a list from a producer, and it was weekends, so there was only a 6 o'clock and 11 o'clock newscast. Then you would go in the back, and even though I had Photoshop on resume, that's not actually what I used. We used paint boxes, very expensive graphic systems that used to be a big thing until Photoshop was just so cheap, and it was ridiculous to buy paint, $80,000 paint boxes. Even to this day, though, you cannot design as fast as you can on an expensive paint box. I mean, I don't know if you've ever seen one, but it's all there's a big tablet looking at just a big screen. The one I used was a Quantel paint box. Quantel is still around, but paint boxes, probably not so much. And you would just do everything with your pen, and maybe you had a little grip that you would just do some quick changes around in menus, and you could just fly on that machine. Now, I wasn't a great designer, but I was kind of learning as I went. And I kind of learned by, you know, the producers like, oh, I like that one. It's like, okay, I got to put that back in the, I got to put that in the memory. Something about that they liked. And so it took a while to figure out, and I kind of learned on the job, because the bar wasn't high for me to like, oh, it needs to be amazing, masterpieces. It's just like, it's a grind. You got to crank away on these graphics and build them fast enough before they go on air. So I would sit there, design all the OTSs, full screens, type graphics. And then when the news started, this was a middle-sized market, a really good middle-sized market in Chattanooga, Tennessee. I would then go in and operate, a generic term would be the character generator for the show. I would sit next to the director, and the audio person was over here, and the studio was in another room. And, you know, and the character generator was really easy. It's just like, okay, anchor's name, read next, news story, next, next. It was, you know, it's a really basic. I just looked at it as like it's a typing job. I didn't really like it that much, but it was fun being in the control room. So as years went on, that machine, the character generator, they would buy bigger and better ones. And now timelines were involved in this and that and high-end design. And I started liking that in more. So it was kind of a day-to-day.
You talked a little bit about the evolution of what you do now, looking at timelines, creating graphics, and then recreating them through Chiron expression and those kinds of things. Can you give us a little bit more background on what you do day-to-day working with RSNs or working with teams and environments that help display the graphics after they're created and what you're doing and what that process is now?
Yeah. So the transition from local news to sports, I was all in on, at the time, the machine was a Chiron Duet. I just kind of call it Chiron generically, but there's very specific machines and software as you go along. And I was just obsessed with that and got really good at that. And then found another station in Providence, Rhode Island that was really high end into graphics. So I went there and I pushed it as hard as I could. Did a freelance job, happened to be my first freelance job ever. They hired the Celtics director, and then it all went. He's like, oh, I didn't know that machine could do that stuff. And it all kind of started from there. So then once I got into sports, I always like to describe it as I kind of came in the back door to get in to designing for big projects. Cause like, oh, there's like this, cause usually a graphics guy is like, you know, I'm like in a sports world is you're really good at sports. Yeah. I mean, you know, sports, you're an expert. You don't have to design anything. You don't have to know anything about design. At least you need to be able to type fast, be a little tech savvy, and you're just grinding away, typing graphics before the game starts. And that's a typical description of a graphics operator. And there's nothing wrong with that. That's just a job you do. And there's a lot of people that do it well. And I did, and that's what I did. But then I also had the design background, animation background. And, you know, the producer could be like, oh, I really wish this could happen. Well, okay, stand by. Like, whoa, you know, it's like, so I kind of snuck in the back door in the design world in sports, and you travel around the country working jobs, you get to know producers, directors. And I've always liked it because not only will I design graphics for like a sporting event or, you know, a team or something like that, or game presentation, but I also know how to execute it. So I could design a package, create the package for the system, like Chiron or Expression. And I know what it's like when you're sitting in that chair, pushing the buttons to get it on television. So it's kind of, it's kind of been my, like I said, backdoor into the industry.
For you being a freelancer, you know, I think there's a good mix of people that listen to this, both freelance and kind of, you know, staff professionals. But, you know, for those that maybe aren't as familiar with the freelance world, and especially in graphics, I mean, what does that look like for you? How do you go about building a client base? How do you go about booking jobs? Like, what does the freelance lifestyle look like for a graphics professional?
So I've been on my own since 2007, doing my own thing. It's been great. Met a lot of great people over the years. I'm really proud that every client always comes back. So over the years, I collect clients, and I don't really do a lot of self promotion. So this is really hard for me to talk about myself. but it's, I get like a call, hey, blah 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 from this team, give me your name, we need you. Okay. So it really comes down to, you know, keeping the customers happy, and it's all about long-term, supporting them well, taking care of them, knowing when, oh, I got to step in and fix this, or I need to help them with this big challenge here with this certain graphic, or, oh, their operators aren't as experienced. They're young in the business. So I need to really simplify things. It's just all about, you know, taking care of the clients. Making friends, networking, of course. But it's not like I'm filling up my Instagram feed or Twitter feed or anything like that with tons of work. It's just every now and then I got to do it. And I'm like, okay, here you go. You know, it's like, all right, time to, cause I know I have to promote it a little bit. You know, it's hard for me to do sometimes.
Yeah, I get that. I'm bad at that too. I hate doing that side of things. And there's so many in this industry that are great at it, and it's an important part of it, but it's just so weird to me to like post my workplaces. And I just like, if you look at any of my social feeds, it's just so much personal and stuff that I care about on the side, outside of a work, or like pipe, you know, pumping up other people's work. It's just, it's a very weird thing to have to pump your own work. Yeah. And I'm thankful that as, you know, staff, I'm a little less, it's less necessary for me to do that, but it's still a weird thing.
Yeah. I constantly have this fear like, oh no, what if someday I'm not busy and
yeah,
I haven't been promoting myself enough, but I do enjoy free time. So I find things to do during free time if that happens. But like this time of year is really busy. You know, I talk to Justin often and it's just like, okay, we need this game presentation. Oh no, our first game's in a month. We just got the graphics. Ah, you know, so. It's a crazy one. I definitely stay busy, but like I said, I love free time. One thing I like to do, and Justin knows this, is constantly learn. You know, I've been around the business for a while, but I'm constantly trying to learn a new technique or something I've missed over the years or never knew. And a big bonding thing from Justin and me is he introduced me to School of Motion, like the very first animation boot camp. I was like, what? This is great. And I've just become obsessed, but I'm also a really bad student. Every time I sign up, it's like another project comes in. Oh, somehow I got to pull off, you know, a little bit at night and then work during the day. So I'm like the quiet guy in the class and I'll never post anything. I barely turn in homework, but I truly love School of Motion, even as the worst student in the class. Absolutely love it. I think I've done like 6 or 7 courses over the years quietly, but I just love School of Motion. I also did MoGraph Mentor, and that was a really good one also, just to have access to really high-end designers and to learn process. And I just never want to stop learning. Even if I even consider retirement, which I probably won't, I love it so much. I would still be taking courses if they're a good course.
I mean, what are maybe some of the most recent things that you've learned or taken away that, like, you know, you've started to apply in your work? Or it's just always interesting for me to hear people, you know, mid-career, like learning and growing and what that looks like when you're already, you know, as far into your career, you know, and as successful as you already are, Zach.
Cinema 4D, I've learned a lot over recently. I I feel like if you don't work in Cinema 4D every single day, you're going to be okay, kind of like me. Okay. You know, I put out real work, but it could be a lot better. And every course that has the word Cinema 4D attached to it, it's like, oh, that's the fastest way. Oh, okay. That's how I get Redshift to render a little bit faster. So it's just Cinema 4D is this constant battle where I can't use it every day. I don't use it every day. And I even have people that I hire to help, especially like high-end modeling and stuff like that. Just anything in Cinema 4D, constantly learning. Some of the design courses at School of Motion and MoGraph Mentor, just little things like to be obsessed with contrast. It's especially if I design like an insert look, it's all about, hey, I need to read something on the screen and I need to read it clearly. And like we used to say across, you know, on the other side of the bar so I can see it, but now it's more like, oh, so I can also see it on a small screen. So it needs to be, you need to have strong contrast in your designs. That is so key. Strong contrast is huge. And, there's another thing I learned, like spacers. I don't know if that's what they called it in the class, but every time I design like an insert look, I start in Photoshop, I set it up. Everything, I just like to have perfect spacing around and perfect sizes, and everything needs to match perfectly. So I have like a spacers layer turn on. It's just ugly blue boxes all over the screen. And that's like an obsession I want things to breathe. I want things spaced out nicely. And you just need good readability. Like I said, from it used to be across from the bar, but now on the small screen.
So just a couple of detail things.
Yeah. Extreme details. Just a couple.
So you talk a lot about the learning different programs, incorporating Cinema 4D into your workflow. And you also just mentioned Photoshop, you know, doing your layouts initially in there. Can you talk us through your process? Because getting something from Photoshop into Cinema 4D or After Effects and getting it animated is different than the graphics packages that you build for Chiron, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yep. Or like an expression. So to start off, like it starts out with the client, you know, you finally get hired, which takes forever. You know, sometimes months before you're officially hired. It's a very slow moving process. You get to the point where you're like, okay, I somehow need to pull out of your brain, which is usually not a designer, like what you want your graphics package to kind of look like. So I talk to them, you know, because it's mostly like an executive or something like that, or someone who runs a game presentation department or a network or something like that. Like for an example, when I did a little small package for Monumental Sports Network in DC, this great client, and he's like, I can't really explain, Zach, exactly what I want, but it's a little this, little that. So what I do is I have documents that I send with just a bunch of designs. Some of them are mine, some of them are other clients. And I even put credit, like, this is, you know, from this network. I'm real honest about it. Now, what you're looking at is like $1 million budget, just the reality. And so you just keep your expectations with your budget compared to, because, you know, they're going to have a huge team and they may have 2 years to work on it. Literally, I've heard Fox Sports had like a World Cup soccer package. And they hired a high-end design firm and they spent 2 years working on it. And I was like, wow, that's a dream right there.
Is it though?
Okay, well, yeah, that's a good point. That's a good point.
There are times I spend 2 weeks looking at a project and I'm tired of looking at it. I can't imagine 2 years, right?
Yeah, that's a really good point.
I mean, there has to be a middle ground though in some respects, better than, you know, a couple months versus. So I guess what, before you get back into explaining what you're just talking about, how long is a typical project once it gets awarded? After you said it, you know, it takes a couple months to get awarded. How long do you usually have to execute at that point?
Well, it depends. So sometimes I'm also the designer, and sometimes I will after they hire this high-end design agency, I will get the deliverables and then I'll break it apart and then absolutely recreate it and animate it all inside the systems. So it depends on the project. If I'm designing and doing the graphics package, and it's a small to a medium-sized package, 4, 5, 6 months. If they hire like a design agency and it's all ready to go, ready for me to grab, like on a Dropbox or something and start cranking away, around, if I had to do it really fast, maybe a month. And sometimes I have to hire like one or two friends to help because it's a lot of work. Because when you design in After Effects or Photoshop or stuff like that, you design it, you type in your sample text, and okay, here you go. Well, I have to then make it where you can edit it, kind of like Justin, you do Mogurts for, in After Effects for Premiere. It's like you're making Mogurts, but, thousands of them. Because sometimes you'll deliver a package, and I like to always look at the very end, right-click properties. Oh, wow, 15,000 files. It's not like I design every single file because you have macros to replicate files for like rosters, jersey, 0 through 99. You have macros to help you with that because it's, you attach it to spreadsheets to feed the rosters. But there is a lot of work involved, Sometimes what I'll do is I'll spend a week or two just breaking it all apart. And tip, After Effects, auto crop on AE scripts is the greatest thing for that. There's a button you press, auto crop, either if it's an image you're pulling from After Effects or if it's a full animation, auto crop duration. Wow, that is huge. Back in the day, it was all about setting up your crop region of interest and then setting it up when on your render output cropping, but that's been a huge time saver. It's been a game changer for me breaking apart pieces. Because I'll take an After Effects project and I may break it into 10, 20 pieces just because I know how I have to recreate it inside the system. So it's a long process. And sometimes a client will have a small budget, will have a short amount of time, and you sit down and you're like, okay, well, we can do this, maybe this chunk of graphics will not animate because we got to make this deadline and make this budget, because I know like, okay, I won't have to hire this many people to help with this big project. I could just do it all in this amount of time if I have the time. So there's so many variables in the process.
As you're talking through all the different things that need to go on, and so since you're designing and animating and then creating the package within the software so that they can use the package on either a big screen or on broadcast or in different places, the process can take different amounts of time versus when you just get something from a design firm and you're creating the package so that they can air it. That's essentially what you just outlined there, right?
Yes, exactly. It just depends on what parts you're involved with. And sometimes it's harder if someone else designs it because there's a lot of strategy involved. And sometimes that's good that they didn't have to worry about what I did because it didn't hold them back. So there's a lot of pros and cons either way. But if I know we have the short window, small budget, then there's going to be a lot of strategy involved. And I'm real upfront and very clear with the clients of what's happening.
So I also want to go back to you before I interrupted you. You had started talking about the process of how you get buy-in from or help somebody, an executive. You try and go into their head and pull out what they're looking for. So can we pick up on that process and
yeah,
go further with that, because you'd started to talk about sharing the some graphics, whether it's yours or somebody else's, with budget attached to it so that they could identify where their budget falls within that. And then where do you take it from there?
Yeah. So if I'm talking to the executive, we talk about what they want. They kind of don't really have the words to explain. It's And they're almost literally word for word. Like, it's in my head. I just can't get it out. So what I do is I show them a bunch, a document of a bunch of other designs, my designs, network designs. And say, for instance, I'll have like 30 examples. I'm like, okay, here's your homework. Go and look at these 30 examples and tell me what you like or don't like. If you're indifferent, just skip it. That's fine. So I'll get this sometimes huge, like 5-page report, and sometimes it's half a page. And most times that's all I need. So I'll look at them like, okay, so I kind of have an idea. They like this type of style. And I'll never copy that style. And I'll tell them, like, there's no copy in it involved. That will not be happening. So I'll explain what they told me. And I'm like, so when you say you like this, why exactly? When you say you don't like this, explain that a little more. Because it's, you're kind of just saying, oh, I don't like this thing. I don't understand why. And so sometimes what I do is I'll take all the information. I'll make like one example, maybe. If it's an insert look, I'll make, you know, maybe a lower third of a player or something like that. I'll show it to them. And sometimes what I'll do is I'll create a little animation if there's time, explaining like, okay, here's your logo. Here's your colors. This is the design. This is doing this because of this. And I'm pulling the brand from this look, from your logo. This is why I do this and that. And most times they love it. And they're like, oh, yes, that's exactly. Oh, yes, yes. And then, you know, he'll forward it around to other executives or his boss. You know, and I'm thinking of one example in my head right now, like I was saying with Monumental Sports. And I think almost his quote was, it's like Zach, when he forwarded it to the executives, he was like, it was like Zach pulled it right out of my brain, exactly what I wanted. So it's like, I love it when I come up with a design or animated package that the client wants, not what I want, but exactly what they want. It's the greatest feeling. Because I, you know, I'm not there to design, to show off to other designers or to like, oh, I want something for my reel. It's all about just giving the client exactly what they want. If they, and you know, sometimes I'll hear, I just want it simple, clean. I want just to be able to read it. I want a long shelf life. So that means not too wild and crazy. They want large font so it can be seen like on a small screen, things like that. And you, it's just all about, you know, like I've heard a producer once told me, I don't want the design or animation to get in the way of the content. It's all about the content and just getting that information to the viewer.
So how do you take and distill when you're saying you don't copy, when you're going through that process with them and understanding what they're looking for? How do you then take that information and turn it into something that you feel like will hit the mark of what they're looking for without copying what other people are doing?
I don't know if I can come up with an exact example, but I remember I had this ribbon look on the Monumental Sports look that it would kind of animate up and kind of wrap itself around, just a real simple boom, boom on the lower third. And there was something he liked on another look. It wasn't even a ribbon. It was some little piece, I guess, that was horizontally sticking out of some of a graphic. And I don't remember exactly what it was. But I'm like, okay, so he wants some type of flourish. And I'm thinking, what exactly did I come up with? And the Monumental Sports logo has this like steep angle on the M of its logo. So what I did is a lot of the look, you know, has that steep angle look. And I made like a ribbon that matched that look that came up and then wrapped itself underneath. And all it was is just two pieces really. But when you animate it, it kind of has a look that it's going up and down. So that was something that was like, okay, want some kind of flourish, but it needs to be some kind of branded part that Matt that says, hey, I'm part of the Monumental Sports Network.
Yeah, that makes sense. Gotcha. We've talked a little bit about the graphics building working within the graphics. How did you get involved with, you talked about getting into Rhode Island and getting into sports. How did you get involved with NBC Sports that allowed you to get to the Olympics?
The very first job was, you know, a lot of my friends, you know, that start, you know, in the sports world, you know, right out of school or something. It's a different, you know, it's a different path for them because, you know, they're growing up in the ranks in sports. I kind of just picked one thing and local news grew, got really good at this one very specific thing at an obsessive level. And then kind of accidentally fell in the sports world, like, whoa, this guy knows this one little thing. And that's how I kind of just immediately started on graphics, operating graphics. And then you start to travel with the team when you're operating graphics for, you know, a package. You meet people around the country. You hire like a graphics assist and like, oh, hey, yeah, I have another client that, oh, they would really like what I just saw you do here. Can you give me your number? And it kind of goes from there. And then you start, you know, going to like, you know, because it was a regional level. But then you start like, the network starts to notice some things from, hey, who did this? What is this? And you start becoming friends with people at the network level. Your name kind of gets out there because there's the people that design packages. There's not a ton of us for that specifically for like Expression or, you know, or Chiron type machines. And Viz is a big one too. That's usually done at a high end network level and they usually have people in house or they hire Reality Check out of LA to do stuff like that. So, you know, for the smaller shows, smaller packages, medium-sized packages, it's usually Chiron or Expression. So over the years, you just become friends with people. And like for the Olympics, you know, I've knew of this director, really good NBC director. I happen to do a network show. We knew of each other. And he's like, oh, hey. Oh, what are you doing next February? What do you have in mind? What do you think about going to Russia? And just stuff like that. Like, just because, oh yeah, he's right here in front of me and he's operating graphics for me today. And I remember that particular one, it was at, we were at UMass doing a basketball game and they wanted to do this special thing because the announcer was from that school. So they found a picture of him. So I made this thing during lunch where I took his picture in college to his, you know, older self now and blended a special little graphic and they all like, oh, they're all having fun with it. It wasn't anything for, you know, a UMass fan watching, but it was fun for us in the truck, you know, so we were just having fun. Like, oh yeah. Hey Zach, what about in February? You come to Russia and just little things. And I'm the same way when I hired people, like we're hanging out like, oh, you know what? I got this thing coming up. How about, are you available to work? You know, things like that. It's just, you gotta have to be at the right place at the right time. A lot of luck is involved. And once you're presented an opportunity, you just have to go with it because you want more of those similar opportunities.
Well, and be likable, right? I mean, you gotta be someone that, because to your point, a lot of that stuff does come just, you know, if you're someone that people want to be around, like it goes a long way to be personable and not, you know, that grump sitting there in front of the Chiron.
Exactly. Yeah. You have this big project that's going to take a long time and it'd be cool to hang out with people you like that. Oh, you have that skill. Let's hang out. Yeah. Let's do this project together. Yeah, exactly.
Absolutely. you know, when I'm hiring freelancers, like I have to hire camera and sound operators and stuff for what we do when we go out in the field. And I mean, it goes a long way. If I find a camera guy that I want to hang out with and spend, you know, even a day or two with, it's like, okay, yeah, I'm much more likely to hire you because I just enjoy being around you. Like, even if your skill set is like, even with three other people, I like hanging out. So let's do this.
Yeah. I have this one guy that I've always liked him a lot. And I hired him really, you know, really young, and his experience was lower. And I've been training him over the years through each package, and he's awesome now. And it's like, now I could just be like, here are the pieces, you know what to do. You know, like, I love it. But in the past, he would sit right over here next to me, and I'd be sliding over a lot. Oh, try it this way. Do this, do that. And he's awesome. Good job, Snowman. Love you, buddy.
Now on Olympics, I mean, how does a show like that, obviously big scope, you know, big budget production, how does that differ from, you know, what you're working on maybe on a day to day for the RSNs? And I mean, what things are different when you're on a show like that?
So with the Olympics, like a quick story of how that started, you know, like I said, the first one I was operating in Sochi. And then ever since then, I was asked by Dave Melfi from NBC Sports to join the integration team. So we spend months before building the package, you know, for Lyric X in Chiron or something like that. So I became, you know, so when I would go to the Olympics after that, I would show up and I would build graphics. I would assist other venues. He has this great team of people that we just put the package together, put designs together. We're right next to the creative director, Dave Barton, who's the most amazing designer in the world. So humble, so nice. And that's kind of how I started with that. And I've been doing the integration side. But during Tokyo, they're like, oh, we can't. Zach, we need someone to operate. You got to go to Tokyo and operate. Even though I was supposed to be on the integration team, I had to show up and operate. And like you were asking, how do things work? Well, I did the two big shows, and one is opening ceremonies and one is the primetime show, you know, the one Tirico show at night. So opening ceremonies, I've ran backup for this one time before, but I've never actually was directly on the air. I ran the Parade of Nations graphic, and I don't know if anyone's ever seen opening ceremonies. It's a graphic. Well, there's a graphic per country, and every graphic has all these options. This, and that. So I had to operate that this year, and you're on the air for your graphic. A series of graphics is on the air for 2.5 hours.
I do think people probably have seen the opening ceremonies. That's just a random guess.
Well, I was an absolute mess before that and was scared to death. I didn't show it to anybody. I was so scared because, you know, it's live, and then they show it again later, but you're actually live. In the past, they would record it and then edit it all day and then show it later, depending on time zones, of course. And I was an absolute mess, scared to death. And we were still like tweaking, you know, up until the last second. So in that world, besides that graphic that one job I had to do, at the network level, you're never set up to fail. There's no, so especially at NBC. So for the Olympics, like an example, like if I'm doing a regional show, I'll be, you know, as an operator, I will be operating two channels. You know, someone will call it the front and back, or font one, font two, whatever you want to call it. Okay, your full screen's on the back channel. Hey, your lower third's on the front channel. Yep, sure, thanks, got it. You know, that kind of thing. You go to the Olympics, even though your whole career is operating two channels or even other stuff on the side, you know, still stores or clip players, this and that. When you show up to the Olympics, like, okay, well, instead of just one person, we're going to put you with two people, two graphics producers, and everything's just going to be quadruple, triple check, you know, triple check, quadruple check before it hits air. And we're going to rehearse every free second before we go on air. You rehearse so many times, after a while, you're like disoriented. Like, wait, was that live or is that rehearsal again? Because they're like, oh, we have a 5-minute break. Stand by. This is how we're going to do it. 3, 2, 1, boom. Okay, let's do it one more time. All right, stand by. You know, and like, oh, okay, that was live. Okay. It's just perfection is expected, but they don't set you up to fail at all. I mean, the care and the thought and everything about the Olympics is just at the highest level. And, you know, over the years somehow slipped in, but I am like working with like the best in the country at what they do. And it's such an honor to roam the same halls with these people. And everyone is, and it's almost like they, all the people there, they don't have egos. They're humble. I mean, they're just super nice and professional. And it's just a breath of fresh air with all the people you work with. And sometimes I only see them every 2 to 4 years. So it's, you're never set up to fail at the high level. And I've always really appreciated that and respected that.
When you were in Tokyo, you talked about the opening ceremonies and then Tariko show that you ran graphics for. How much time? Yeah, obviously, if you go to your Instagram, you get a little bit of sights and sounds, but you also have talked about how time intensive it is when you're involved with the Olympics and what all it takes on a daily basis. So for a show at night, what all goes into the background of building the graphics or prepping in order to get to the presentation or the live show?
Well, at that level, there are so many people involved, and you could go the whole Olympics and maybe see 10, 20% of those people involved because you're way down here and the control room's way over there and tape, they're way over here and the production offices are over here. And it's, there's just so many people involved. It's, you don't see every single element, and you're so busy, you don't really get to go out and hang out and socialize as much. You're just socializing with the people you work with directly. So like a typical day would be, I would wake up around 3:45 a.m. and I would start the day at 5 a.m. Then we would go on air, I believe it was 9 a.m. And we would be on the air for 6 to 7 hours straight. And then and then as soon as you're off the air, you're done for the day. So, and when I say 6 to 7 hours straight, if I was doing a game for 6 or 7 hours straight, I would just be completely wiped out. You're, you know, throughout the show, you're tossing to this venue, to this special piece. So it's not like I'm cranking away on graphics nonstop, but that's, you know, there's this huge amount of people there just putting it on and it's just, you're working like crazy hours. And Tokyo was different because at the first 14 days, we're on a soft quarantine where you can only work and go to your hotel and that's it. So I didn't really get to do a lot, few hours. So by the time after 14 days, I was at least used to the schedule. So, you know, a friend or two and I would go out and just like, all right, let's go sightsee whatever is walkable or hop on a train and just do something for a couple of hours before we have to go back to bed. It was like this small window you could go see things. I didn't get to do it often, but especially at the beginning. But they were very long days, but you loved every minute of it, you know, especially looking back. At the time, it may have been worn out, you know, during the day, but looking back, it's always such a great experience.
When you talk about your path and getting into what you do today, it sounds like there's a lot of time when you just committed and applied yourself. So if you were talking to young students who get into this and want to get in to do what you do, what's the advice or feedback that you would give to them?
Yep. Right now is the luckiest time to, if you are considering this world, because every school, you know, and Garrett, you definitely know this, has at least an expression machine now for their ESPN Plus shows. And it's unbelievable. And ESPN hands over this $1 million plus beautifully designed, perfectly made graphics package for the expression and say, okay, guys, put on a show. You know, and they obviously hand out a great animation package and everything. And students and sometimes employees get to put on a high quality show early on in their career. And it's just amazing. And I follow a lot of people that are in those early stages of their career, show, you know, talking about their ESPN Plus show and this and that. And I'm just like, wow, this is the time. Now, a lot of people, even those students that are in that job, don't even kind of understand my world and just think like, okay, today I'm operating expression, but I really want to direct and punch, you know, TD the show, which I've done in local news before. And I did enjoy it, but I just obsess with graphics and design. So I didn't choose that path. So a lot of it is considered like a stepping stone. Even in my world at the regional level, a lot of people like will start there, or a graphics producer type person, graphics coordinator, PA, whatever you want to call it. And they'll be a tape AD down the road. They'll become a producer. They'll become a director. And it's a good stepping stone. But just an expression is an amazing machine. I have friends that work both at Ross and Chiron. And I love those guys. And, you know, there's pros and cons of each machine. But an expression at every college, wow, so, so lucky.
Yeah, I think last thing here before we let you go here, Zach, is just I think one of the questions that I like to ask, because I think you can learn a lot from it, both professionally and just about the person, is, you know, if there's a specific time that you remember that you failed or something went completely wrong or haywire, and you know, how you responded and what you learned from it. I think those moments in someone's career can be some of the most telling. So I'd be curious to hear your story about that.
As soon as you say, like, when have you failed? Like, you know, 100 typos just flew through my mind over many years. Really bad, embarrassing. No, you can't even explain it. There's no excuse. It's just like, where'd that even come from? A lot of that has happened. Now, I don't go around talking about it or laughing about it that much because it was really painful. It's hard because especially if you do anything like at a network level, that's just really embarrassing. And everyone in the truck knows, even the 20-year-old guy running the cables, the utility, is like, oh my gosh, how embarrassing, you know? So it's like, you definitely need to know how to spell well. You definitely need to be a good speller.
Even the nicest directors in the world get awfully loud if they see a misspelling.
Yes, and you can't blame them. You're like, wow, somehow that went through my fingers. I actually typed that in a rush, and it made it on television, and this is terribly embarrassing. You know, but then I have some crazy ones that I kind of do chuckle about because I'm definitely the one that, like, for this one example, this was years ago in local news. I'm sitting there working on some graphics, just cranking away, building some pre-pro stuff. And I have an alarm that goes off, like, oh, I have to put in I press a button and a little tease pops up on the screen while you're watching your primetime show, teasing the news tonight at 11. So, you know, I'm cranking away. Oh, man, we gotta hurry up and finish this. Alarm goes off. Tease tab number one. I'm sorry. 1, 2, 3, 4, 6. Next. 1, 2, 3, 4, 6. Okay. Okay, then get back to work. 5 minutes later, a producer comes rushing down. Hey, Zach, did you put in the tease tabs just now? Like, yep. 8:15, like I always do. Yeah. Well, we just put, like, triple murder suicide over Rudolph the reindeer. And I was like, oh, wow. So I'm like, okay, let's learn from this. Let's read the teases before I put them on the air, and let's focus what's actually on television, because people actually do see this. And then when they see this, because their kids are crying, they actually call the station. So there's little things like that. So
Donner was so pissed.
Yeah.
To be fair, I mean, I'm reading Bambi with my kids right now, and Bambi's mom gets shot, and they wonder where she goes.
Yeah. To a farm, so kids. Rudolph is on a farm somewhere.
But to make it even worse, a month later, there was a small little paragraph in a magazine talking about this TV station that put up that I think the title was like, they had a murder suicide on Rudolph or something. But I was like, really? Really? One little paragraph. And I was like, wow.
You know, you haven't lived until you've been immortalized for your mistakes in print.
Yeah. It's like, wow. That's unbelievable. So there are those failures in life that, you know, you eventually can laugh at. That was just because that was just so ridiculous on so many levels, especially the big slap in the face in print a month later, right when you're getting over it. So there are those things, but failures, I'm sure there were so many, many, many.
Well, thank you so much for making Creative Sports Podcast part of your day. We'd love to hear your thoughts, feedback, and suggestions, so pop on over to the Sports Creative Community on Slack and connect with us and your fellow creatives. If you're enjoying this podcast, we'd love it if you shared it with a friend or a coworker, and leave us a 5-star rating so other people will be able to find us as well. And don't forget to subscribe so that you're the first person to catch each new episode. Remember, the world needs your voice, so keep creating.